And I'm so thankful for an opportunity like this to be able to consider an overtly faith-based education.
Welcome to While I Breathe, the official podcast of the ACLU of South Carolina. I'm your host, Paul Bowers.
I'm your other host, Jace Woodrum.
Jace, what do you know about school vouchers? Are you familiar with the term?
So I wouldn't say I was an expert. I guess I know a little bit. I'm familiar. I mean, I think of it as taking money from public schools and giving that money to private schools. And by virtue of that, moving kids from public schools to private schools. But that's probably about what I know.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's the big picture. You know, the way I think about vouchers is that they are a tool for taking public funds and giving them to private schools. And there can be different sort of middlemen along the way, and they might call it different things, but they are a hot topic this year in the South Carolina State House. Right now, as we're recording, it's January. The legislature returns on January the, 14th? And we will see probably the South Carolina Senate take up a bill, Senate Bill 62, in the first week, trying to create and expand school vouchers in South Carolina. So,
Paul, it feels like we've been here before.
Oh, yeah.
Is this Groundhog Day? What's happening?
It is Groundhog Day. yeah, we are repeating history here, and it is eerily familiar. Part of my background, as you know, is I was an education reporter for about 8 years in South Carolina. So I'm the kind of guy, if I drink too much coffee, I'm going to start just spontaneously talking about this stuff. You know, school privatization, school finance, those are like always in the back of my mind. So if you'll indulge me, I want to give just sort of a short history of what led us to this point.
I'm here for it.
So school vouchers are not a very old idea, but they do date back to the mid-20th century. One of the first people to publicly advocate for them was an economist named Milton Friedman. And initially, he pitched the idea in a lot of ways. He was partly a libertarian, but he also sold the idea in part to parents seeking to avoid the racial integration of public schools. So he made that argument in 1955, which if you're a history buff, you'll recognize that as a year after Brown v. Board of Education.
Wow. I mean, you know, it's like so many of the policies that we work so hard to stand against are rooted in racism and this idea of white supremacy. And here we have yet another example in vouchers.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's the unavoidable origin story. You know, voucher lobbyists don't like it when you bring it up, but it's the ugly truth. That's our history. And, you know, there are a lot of reasons why people advocate for vouchers. You know, some of them have to do more with current day issues that we're going to get into in a minute. You know, a lot of times people are looking for vouchers to avoid sharing a school with LGBTQ people. In other cases, people might sincerely believe that a voucher will get their kid access to a better education. But again, as we'll get into, it's not always the case. Private schools are not necessarily doing a better job than public schools. So vouchers really came onto my radar around the turn of the millennium in South Carolina. There was a guy named Howard Rich, which is one of those kind of perfect names, but he was he still is. I think he's still around. He's a New York real estate developer. He's pretty well known in these circles. He served on the board of the Cato Institute, which is a pretty influential libertarian-ish think tank founded by Charles Koch. And he started pumping money into state-level politics all over the country, including in South Carolina. And he would give just record-breaking sums of money to candidates for state office. And, you know, this was before Citizens United, you know, that infamous Supreme Court decision that just really threw open the gates for dark money. But he was just setting up limited liability companies in his name so he could max out donations through a gajillion of these little shell companies. So he, again, in that first decade of our millennium was really the driving force behind voucher bills. And for one reason or another, those failed. Those bills never actually passed. The first real push for a voucher plan in this decade came in the wake of COVID-19. So you may remember, you know, in the couple years after the pandemic really started, there was some federal funding that went to the states to provide some relief to public schools. And Governor McMaster tried to divert millions of those dollars to private schools. And this pretty famously got smacked down by the state Supreme Court because our constitution, our state constitution, forbids the public funding of private schools. It's not subtle. It doesn't take a brilliant legal mind to interpret it. But that that case was Adams v. McMaster in 2020. And that failed. But that was kind of the restarting of a voucher-like plan in South Carolina. And then it really kicked into gear in the 2020s, and thanks in large part to another out-of-state billionaire named Jeff Yass. He's a Wall Street guy from Pennsylvania. In South Carolina, famously, his PAC gave $750,000 to support Ellen Weaver's run for state superintendent in 2022. So he started throwing his money around, and suddenly vouchers were a hot topic again in South Carolina. The pushes for vouchers come not from some groundswell of support from South Carolina parents or teachers or students, but in a lot of cases from one or two billionaires who are really pulling the strings here.
It seems hard to imagine that out-of-state billionaires have the answers to South Carolina's troubled public education system.
Yeah, it's hard to know what's in another person's heart of hearts, but you can at least follow the money and see where it goes. So the legislature took action in 2023 and finally passed a voucher law. So it was a limited voucher scheme that was supposed to only help families below a certain income level. It was a limited number of recipients in the first couple years, but that law was struck down, or at least the school funding part of it was struck down last year in another state Supreme Court case, Eadson v. South Carolina Department of Education. So twice now in this decade, we've seen the state Supreme Court point to the state constitution, and it's a pretty clear rule against public funding of private schools and say, no, y'all can't do that. But they haven't given up. So the new tactic, and the one that we will see coming right out the gates in the South Carolina legislature this year, is to divert money from the state education lottery and use that to fund vouchers. The legal theory, I guess, is that's not public money because it's not tax money. You know, I'm not a lawyer, but we'll see how that holds up in court. But that is that's the tactic now. They're reintroducing a very similar bill to the law that passed and was struck down, with just that tweak to the funding mechanism, and also a few other changes, including a deletion of the few anti-discrimination policies that were in the old law. They're just striking those. And so the new law would expand the threshold so that nearly all South Carolina families would be eligible for these vouchers. So,
okay. Whoa, Paul, it seems like we're getting worse. The state Supreme Court strikes down efforts twice, and we have a new bill that seems to be getting worse, not better. Our legislators don't seem to be learning from this at all. And what that makes me think of is, like, number one, the state legislature believes it can intimidate or control our state Supreme Court because they, you know, choose who sits on our state Supreme Court. So they are just egregiously flouting state Supreme Court rulings and saying unabashedly that public dollars can go to private schools that, in essence, have been given a license to discriminate, a license to say you can't come here because you're gay, or you can't come here because your parents are transgender, or you can't come here for any number of reasons. And here we go again. It is kind of astounding to me when I just process everything you just laid out for me.
Yeah. You're preaching to the choir here. Yeah. We've seen the legislature really pretty brazenly pass bills that they know are going to end up in the state Supreme Court just to see if it'll work this time. They keep trying it and trying it. And again, it's not really clear who else wants this outside of a handful of funders.
Yeah, even the first year of the last voucher program that was struck down, not even enough kids. They set aside enough money that it wasn't even used. There aren't parents in South Carolina clamoring for this. It's what out-of-state billionaires saying, you got to do it. It's not like some groundswell of support. And I guess one of the other things that comes to mind for me is, you know, I was a kid growing up in South Carolina who got one of those scholarships that's mm-hmm. funded by the lottery. And, you know, it's one of the only reasons why I don't have more student loans than what I have. And so I don't know how we continue to fund those important programs, those higher education programs, as the cost of college gets more and more expensive. And instead we're diverting this money to something that nobody in state is demanding. And you're right, I'm preaching to the choir. You should just tell me to be quiet.
I never will. Yeah, and I'm a fellow recipient of those scholarships too, you know. Not to brag, but I was a Palmetto Fellows recipient, and yeah, that was huge. That that made the University of South Carolina affordable to me. We're opening a real Pandora's box here, and one real practical question is what this does to in-state college scholarships, because vouchers will eat into that revenue stream, absolutely. So today on the podcast, we've got a guest. It is Dr. Josh Cowan. He is a professor of education policy at Michigan State University. He's the author of a book I just finished reading recently. Came out in 2024. It's called The Privateers: How Billionaires Created a Culture War and Sold School Vouchers. Maybe it's a simple question, maybe it's not, but what is a voucher?
So a voucher is any use of public funding, either through the tax code or through general appropriation to subsidize private school tuition. In today's form, you have some voucher plus schemes. That's just not just tuition, but other types of educational expenses, either associated with private schooling or homeschooling. But at the end of the day, a voucher is taxpayer-funded private school tuition.
What does the evidence say about the effectiveness of vouchers? How well do they work, and who do they actually work for?
So after a few pilot-sized programs, so what we're talking about, a few hundred kids here or there in the late 90s, early 2000s, showed some of those hundreds of kids did a little better academically when they used a voucher to transfer from public to private school. Over the last decade, the bigger and the more recent the voucher scheme, the worse the results have been for kids, particularly for lower income and middle income families. And it's been pretty one-sided against vouchers really since about 10 years ago, 2014, early 2015.
And let's talk a little bit about why you have these insights into school vouchers, how well they work. Tell me a little bit about your research, because you've focused specifically on this. You've been in the weeds on vouchers for a while now.
Yeah, so I was a young grad student, of all things, 23 years ago. First started working as a basically a data analyst, program analyst on different public and privately funded evaluations of early days voucher schemes. And certainly was more optimistic at that time that these things, I didn't necessarily know a whole lot about it, but thought it was an interesting question, interested in exploring these things. And they seem new and they seem different, which I think we can't really overstate back then or even now on what people are frustrated with a lot of things they see as a status quo. And so they sort of grapple onto something that sounds cool and sexy. And that was vouchers then, and it may be a little bit now. But, you know, I sort of rose up through the ranks of different professional organizations, done a lot of work on a lot of questions in public policy and education policy, not just vouchers. I think it's actually one reason I'm sort of well positioned to talk about how bad these things are, is to look and see what good is and what bad is in other areas as well, but have really grown up professionally in and around efforts to push vouchers onto taxpayers.
So I just finished reading your book, The Privateers, over the new year, and
not light reading.
You know, some people read ghost stories. You know, some people like to read a little academic history.
Yeah, it's a horror story of sort.
Early on, you know, you acknowledged you were doing this research, and in that world, a lot of the funding for both the implementation of voucher programs and then sometimes the analysis and I guess what's the word for it? The research on the effectiveness of vouchers comes from a handful of philanthropic organizations and sometimes individual donors. You know, talking about people like the Walton Family Foundation, who, you know, they're spending the Walmart fortune on this. We're talking about the Bradley Foundation. Yeah, they're the Kochs are another well-known group. You acknowledge early on that, you know, you're doing this research, and so you are, in the course of your career, doing research funded by pro-voucher and pro-privatization organizations.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about that. You know, you went into the research with an open mind, and then you saw the results, and you began to understand some of where the funding and the motivated reasoning comes from. What was your journey like in that?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a diverse array of funders operating the education reform space, some strictly on the advocacy side, just pushing things through different legislatures and through political means, and then others really more spread out through both just kind of what we might call stakeholder support, actually trying to fund community organizations. You know, we may not necessarily agree with their mission, but they're fairly community-driven, local, state, and local groups. And then there's the research side, which is very much sort of geared toward think tank world. Folks listening to this conversation probably are aware of how, in your case, the Palmetto Institute, whatever it's called, there's one of those in every state, and they're very active in the legislative process. But the money comes from somewhere, and what these folks have learned really at least since the early 90s, and I write a little bit about this in the book, but it's not just education, it's across different forms of policy, is even with all the money in the world, they can't just create, like, break down a system, whether it's healthcare, whether it's education, whether it's social welfare, whether it's defense, if so, it's some of those groups, without claiming something in response. We have to show "quote unquote evidence," and so there, these organizations have been on the front lines of funding research in that space, both at universities, in my case, but also in think tank world again. So I think sometimes folks like sort of think about this and their eyes glaze over. They hear about academics and research in this business, and because there's a lot of perception out there that this stuff is obscure and you know, overly complicated. But I really can't stress enough the role. Like, and I say this in the book, one of the insights that these groups had early in the 90s was to get their policy reforms in place. They really needed to stand up sets of evidence, sets of data, geared both toward litigation and also to legislation, which makes it a little different than sort of typical academic world where they just publish in journals and send it off into the ether, and maybe it gets read one day, maybe it doesn't. This is all very much targeted toward creating facts and data to use in legislation, like in debates about to happen in your state, and in litigation around certain issues, and all questions you might ask: who's using these schemes? How do they work? What's the payoff? What's the bottom line? Stuff like that. Somebody's got to answer those questions, or at least try to. And that's where that research side of things comes in.
There's one of the organizations, the Lindy and Harry Bradley Foundation, called for what they termed a counterintelligentsia.
Yeah.
One organization that we mentioned is the Palmetto Promise Institute. Mm-hmm. A lot of people in South Carolina probably haven't heard of it, or if they did, it's because our state superintendent was a founding leader of that organization, worked in that capacity right up until she became head of our public schools. So yeah, that Palmetto Promise Institute is one of many. There are groups like this, as you say, in states all over the country. It's part of the state policy network. Let's just dig into one of these organizations. What is the State Policy Network? Whose pile of money is that? And what does it try to do?
There's a lot of different national and local donors, and can't speak to every single local donor, but the State Policy Network in general is a network, as the name implies, of conservative think tanks spread all over the country. There's Palmetto, they're all very similar names, by the way. Palmetto Promise Institute in your state, there's the Buckeye Institute in Ohio, the Buckeyes, there's the Badger Institute in Wisconsin, the Badgers, there's the Goldwater Institute in Arizona, there's the Mackinac Institute in my state, there's the Cardinal Institute in West Virginia. There's one of these in most states, yeah. And they're all networked. That's the State Policy Network. Bradley's big funder, very deliberately, and we can carve out specific conversation about that group if you'd like, but Koch's big funder. There's a group called Donors Trust, which is sort of a place they all think of it as the new NIL cooperative, but for right-wing think tanks. So they just all dump their money into one cooperative, and then that group spreads it out to all these different think tanks. And they play in a lot of different issue areas, not just education, although they certainly dominate on education on the right, but everything from local tax policy, energy policy, especially in some state-specific stuff. Like in my state, there's fisheries arguments where the Great Lakes and there's that kind of thing. But the method is the same, and that is sort of very much what they would call free market tax policy, education reform, things like that, trying to get legislators to respond. And they're very, very deeply tied to that world and provide testimony, provide white papers, provide policy briefs, provide experts in court, in some cases provide staffing, like you're seeing in your state. And that's a model they use elsewhere. And this happens on the left too, to some extent. There's not the same sort of level of network or anything like that. But there's some big name think tanks on the left that try to do this kind of thing too, in DC based mostly. But that's the idea. Is you can't just, and I talk about this in the book, you really can't just come in and bust up, despite the kind of the Doge and some of the things you're hearing out of Washington today. We're just going to break it all and not put it back together. The folks who've been doing this for a long time know they have to come up with something. They can't just break public education. They have to kind of claim why they're doing it, and they have to create a rationale for it. And creating that rationale is really what these think tanks do, both in education and across different policy areas.
So talking about the rationale for school vouchers, you open chapter one of your book with a quote from the economist Milton Friedman, in which he was pitching school vouchers in 1955. Crucially, obviously, this was the year after Brown v. Board of Education, so public schools were being ordered to integrate. Yeah. And what Milton Friedman said was, under such a system, there can develop exclusively white schools, exclusively colored schools, and mixed schools.
Yeah.
And you return to that quote and that framing often in this book. Tell me a little bit about that. Like, why is that origin story so important for understanding school vouchers even today?
Well, we're back in it today. So in the 90s, they had started to pivot away from some of this sort of parent values type stuff. And this was very strategic to try to make this, especially in the courts, an argument that actually school choice was the new racial integration movement. And actually vouchers in particular was the new racial integration. All that was strategic, incredibly cynical, strategic on the right wing sort of side to do this. So it's just important for that reason alone to remember that these things started in that sort of dark area. I don't, when I speak publicly on these issues sort of around the country, nothing gets a lot of these voucher organizations worked up as when I say something mean about Milton Friedman. And I don't have a whole lot of interest in what this mid-century Chicago-based conservative economist thought about much of anything these days. He's been passed away for 20 years. He's not going to put food on the table in your state or in Eastern Kentucky or West Texas or in Idaho or wherever else is dealing with these things. It's not very interesting, except as a matter of the historical record, whether Milton Friedman personally was or was not a segregationist. What is important is that segregationists immediately latched onto Friedman's idea. And at the time, it was about race. There's some of that going on today. But the things have moved as the arc of history has continued. It's not just that anymore. It's about, you hear this phrase, parents' values, parents' rights all the time, as if parents have no agency or ability to work in public school settings through their boards or parent-teacher conferences and things like that. A lot of this stuff has been, since the 50s, code for, if not on the issue of race, at least the idea that parents have the right to isolate their children, separate their children out from other children, keep those other children away from their children, whatever the reason, whether it's race, whether it's gender identity, whatever it is, and to use public dollars to do it. That's the really the key piece here of public policy. There's no one's really debating that parents don't have some right to do those things if that's their goal. Courts have weighed in on the extent to which parents and children are different people, and states and feds have an incentive in protecting children. But setting that piece aside, the real issue here is not parents' rights, it's what parents have the right to do with taxpayer dollars. And that's where things get kind of dicey. And that's why it's really important to remember that dating all the way back to the 1950s, the whole idea behind these things was to give public dollars to parents who wanted to separate and isolate themselves out from publicly funded schools and school districts.
So one of the salient issues in South Carolina now, one of the reasons that advocates of vouchers give for creating and continuing voucher programs is avoiding civil rights provisions for LGBTQ people. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And in South Carolina, before the state Supreme Court struck down the voucher law or the school funding portion of it, the state released a list of schools that were eligible to receive voucher funding. And it's several hundred. The majority religious, at least 2/3 we know are Christian schools, which is not surprising. You know, if you grew up here, you know that's what the majority of private schools are here.
And that's national too. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And it's hard to assess them on their academics because they don't take the same assessments. You know, right. It's really hard to compare apples to apples. But one thing that does stand out is if you read through the student handbooks or the family handbooks, many of them have explicit discrimination policies written into their handbooks. So to read some samples here, there are some that will expel students if they become pregnant. One says, quote, "We will not accept or condone any student who is in a same-sex relationship." Another says, "Students are expected not only to be neat and clean at all times, but also to reflect either a feminine or masculine identity in their appearance based on their gender identified on the student's birth certificate." Yeah. One last one, the school says that it, quote, "enrolls students from all types of families, but does not necessarily affirm the lifestyle choices of any given family." Right. So reading that, it does harken back to Milton Friedman, and not on the topic of racial integration, but it is saying, well, look, you know, if we open up the gates, parents can choose. Yeah. Is that common? I mean, the kind of provisions we're seeing in these schools, do you see that across the country?
100%. And there's been a lot of good investigative journalism based in state capitals. Little Rock comes to mind, Madison in Wisconsin comes to mind. In the Raleigh area, North Carolina actually done some work similar on this. So folks have started to, Indianapolis too, for that voucher scheme. So this issue, that some of the things you just listed are certainly really common. And what's important to know is that 10 plus years ago, most voucher systems in place had some at least gentle prohibition against all of discriminating on all the things that you just described. They may not have just listed those things categorically. You can't discriminate on same sex. They may not have listed it that way, but they sort of in general in Louisiana, actually in their version, which spread statewide, where the academic results were so poor, had a base what amounted to an open admissions policy. If you're going to take state funding as a private school, you had to accept whoever applied. And that actually kept a lot of private schools out of participating and taking voucher payments. So the right wing side of things, the other side on this issue, will say that's overregulation. They actually blamed overregulation for the horrific academic results. At that time, they were using the state exam, so you could compare apples to apples. And then they focused on the state exam instead of on the anti-discrimination pieces that schools, because they had some surveys that principals were said, well, we didn't want to take the state exam. That's why we didn't join the voucher program. But they also were telling those same surveys, we don't want open admissions. You know, like a lot of things, the English language, it sort of depends on what your point of emphasis is. If you're calling something open admissions versus discrimination or anti-discrimination. What's important to know is that these days, in all the legislation that's been passed that I've seen for the last 3 years, the discrimination is the point. all of those things that you just listed would fall under, if you do a find and search in the PDF of all this legislation, whether proposed or passed, on the word creed or the word values, but it's usually creed, you'll find it somewhere buried down about three quarters of the way through the document that says something to the effect of nothing about taking public dollars as payment for private school tuition obligates the private school to do anything contrary to its creed or its values. In that statement is baked in the right to discriminate across all those areas that you mentioned. There's a lot of ambiguity about whether or not the right to discriminate on the basis of race still exists. Formally, it does not. Even private schools that aren't taking public money can't reject people on the basis of race. To say nothing of private schools taking public money. The race is sort of the third rail there on what schools are allowed to formally. But that's going to get tested in the courts, right? You can imagine a scenario pretty quickly down the line with one of these things where a school says, we object to woke students. What's really different legally from saying woke versus or a student who might bring CRT into our school? It's not, you know, that's going to get tested alongside a school's right to say require born girls to wear dresses or whatever, where the courts have been generally more favorable toward it. All of this has, the through line here is, it is the ability for schools to separate and isolate out on whatever basis they want. This current moment we're in politically, culturally, is on gender stuff. Historically, it was on race. Those things are combining again. We'll see what happens. But, I think actually the example you gave about the children, the teenagers who become pregnant is really important. You see that a lot because in the Midwest, it's not necessarily evangelical schools, but it's large Catholic diocesan school systems, really, that operate very much like public school systems, and they have the same kind of prohibitions, and they'll just kick people out if they do something that's contrary to that creed or value system.
Yeah, another semantic distinction is when we say school choice, whose choice are we talking about?
It's the school's choice, 100%. And by the way, it's really important just as a parenthetical to that to remember that there's different forms of school choice. School choice, we talked at the top about charter schools, there's inter-district open enrollment. The other side likes to bury everything we just discussed as a form of school choice, parents choosing. What they really mean is public funding for private religious schools. And that's a very different thing than charter schools or these open enrollment things, because we're just not talking about all those issues when we talk about those other types of school choice programs. And it's important not to lump all them together, not that you're doing that, but I do think it's important to kind of separate those things out.
Yeah. Another group of students who may not be well served by vouchers are students with learning disabilities.
Yeah.
You know, in your book, you talk about the case from Wisconsin, which you had some experience researching, and I've got to give a shout out to the ACLU.
Yeah.
Obligatory. The ACLU made a complaint saying that private school vouchers in Wisconsin had created a dual system for students, where public schools were still, by law, of course, required to serve all students, anybody who came to them, whereas private schools receiving public funding could either, in some cases, deny entry to those students, or in other cases, admit them and then later push them out subtly and suggest that they go elsewhere. Yeah, what warnings would you have for families in South Carolina with, you know, students who have special needs or learning disabilities?
Well, it's the culture war stuff gets a lot of the press coverage, but really at the end of the day, the most common way that private schools discriminate in this country when they're publicly funded is on against students with disabilities, ranging from mild, at least on medically mild disability issues to fairly severe. And this is because they're not obligated. And the way these laws have been written, these private schools can choose not to take these students. In the court case you mentioned in Wisconsin, there's some, again, a lot of this comes down to the legal ambiguity, because there's the states will, in some cases, outlaw outright rejection of a kid based on having a disability. And there's federal consistency with federal law on that too, for states taking federal dollars. But this schools get to do the choosing is a really important piece, because there's this kind of, well, it's not going to fit well here. Or in the case of Wisconsin, you saw and still see schools saying, you know, we can work with your child with dyslexia. Now, we're not going to obligate ourselves to putting anything in writing like an individualized learning plan. We're not going to sign a contract with you to say so, but trust us, we're going to get it done. Arizona's attorney general has actually warned that that's an instance at this point of consumer fraud, just sort of Arizona's the most fully developed kind of quote-unquote market for vouchers there. And she's saying, all right, we're in a market now. Education's a consumer good. Let's start talking consumer fraud. Discrimination is the legal term. Consumer fraud's the consumer term, which is schools promising parents, we're going to serve your kid. And then they just kind of say, no, it's not working out. Here, it's October already. Go find a public school to inhabit instead. You're seeing this increasingly commonly in states that are tracking that information.
Yeah, you mentioned Arizona, and that's, I know just from reading the news, a case where a fully established private school voucher program has been causing a budget crisis. Right? I mean, is that something you're seeing around the country where funding is funding for private schools is affecting funding for public schools?
Yeah, in the old days, these were still fairly small pilot-sized programs, and most states, even smaller states, had the money they could find somewhere to fund this type of thing. And Democrats, progressives will have their own pet projects for $20 million here, $30 million there. When you're talking about $1 billion like Arizona's doing or Ohio's doing or Florida's doing, the big three right now, you really are talking about a completely separate system of education. It starts small. It starts limited. It starts with 5,000 kids. It starts with $100 million, which is fairly small to most state budgets. And the argument that the other side will make is, well, we're not taking it out of public school aid at the state level, which is a very technical term. There's usually what's called a state school aid fund or foundation allowance, sort of the school finance world. In the state budget world, there's money in each state sets aside for public education. And the voucher lobby folks will say, well, we're not taking money out of that. We're taking it from somewhere else in state funding, and we're spending it on vouchers. The problem with that is that at the end of the day, it's all the same pot. This is their version of saying, well, because you know, rising gas prices don't affect my ability to pay my mortgage, because in my Quicken worksheet, my household budget, mortgage is a separate line on the worksheet than gas prices, than gas for the month. It's silly. The states can't afford two systems of education. They often can barely afford one. And there's been a lot of litigation about that whole side of things, setting vouchers even out of it. When you start spending $1 billion or even $500 million on a separate system of education, which, by the way, is primarily funding, most voucher users are already in private schools. It's sort of a myth that this is helping parents flee so-called failing public schools. Most voucher users are already in private schools. And when states commit themselves to funding that separate system of education on the private side that 2 years ago or even a year ago, the private sector was paying for itself, that's where you get the budget crisis. And that's where it becomes increasingly difficult to spend on other policy priorities.
The thing that is always going on in the back of my mind when I think about South Carolina public schools, both as a former reporter and as a parent with three kids in the public schools here, is that our state already is defunding its public schools. Even without a fully fleshed out voucher program, the state has not fully funded what it calls the base student cost, which is the amount per pupil that it's supposed to spend since the Great Recession, you know, since like the 08 stock market crash. That amounts to $500 million shortfall every year. And on top of that, when the legislature first proposed this voucher bill, you know, our state has an Office of Revenue and Fiscal Affairs that tries to estimate the impact of bills. They estimated that by 2026, if the voucher program were allowed to expand to all families, regardless of income, it would cost the state around $2.9 billion a year. So, right. Yeah. So we are defunding public schools, and then we're just throwing gas on the fire by doing this.
Everything you just described, by the way, sort of gets back to some of the things we talked about at the top, which is just why these think tanks exist and why they need numbers and data. So one function that these organizations, I don't know if it's happened in the Palmetto Promise exactly, but in other states, this what happens is they'll provide a counter estimate to what you just described and say, no, that's just bureaucrats and saying in Columbia saying this, and it's, and we know this is what the real number is. So this is just, we can't overstate the importance of things like numbers in this space, because that's how they make these arguments. And then they'll circle back on other things. But yeah, at the end of the day, like what's important to remember is that, you know, just like there's a lot of things that don't work with parallels, but think about your own household income. If you haven't had a raise in 5 years, as prices go up, you're going to be hurting. And in real dollar terms, the lack of a raise or a raise that doesn't keep up with the cost of inflation is mathematically the same thing as a cut. And so again, these think tank groups and the voucher advocacy groups rely on a very narrow, they'll say, well, in no instance has vouchers ever cut funding for public schools. All they mean is that somebody didn't literally take $5 out of a school district's pocket and move it to vouchers. But what they're not able to claim, because it hasn't happened, is that vouchers haven't made it harder to fund those base pupil rates that you're describing, or again, it's called different things in different states, but the same idea. You're not paying, many states are failing to pay what they are legally required to, or at least what the expectation is. And any failure to keep up with at least inflation at minimum, or cost of living in general, is the same thing as a cut, whether you're actually taking $10 out or you're just withholding $10. The person is $10 poorer. In this case, that person are public schools and kids and families across these communities.
Yeah. In South Carolina, vouchers are often pitched as a solution to a crisis, which is something you highlight again and again in states around the country in your book, where, you know, there is some state of emergency. In a lot of cases, it's just, you know, the schools in this city are failing. In other cases, it is a, you know, a very physical, natural disaster like Hurricane Katrina.
Yeah. Yeah.
And a voucher system is proposed as a way to swoop in and remedy all kinds of wrongs, you know, whether it is cynically pitched as a way to finally integrate schools, or it's pitched as a way to improve performance for these students who are falling behind. And when I talk to fellow parents, especially who are frustrated about the state of our public schools, that is, I think, the most attractive thing about a voucher, right? That the schools here are struggling. Gosh, like the, you know, classroom sizes keep growing. My kid is not getting the help that she needs with reading or whatever the case may be. What if there was another way? What if there was another school I could send my kid to where they might get the focus and help that they need? Yeah, what do you see as the attractiveness of vouchers, and what are the pitfalls that people need to bear in mind when they're looking at that?
Two things can be true. One is that public schools in general have not always lived up to their requirements or their promises, particularly for kids, say, with special needs, or on issues of race historically, or different kids who are exceptional learners and things like that, or just in general, kids who may deviate a little bit in their learning style from a typical student. That can be true, and vouchers can be emphatically not the solution to that type of ongoing problem. Because remember, like at the end of the day, these things, vouchers are the school's choice. They're not school choice. So, you know, sort of this myth out there, and I use this phrase elsewhere called subprime schools is the phrase I use. And that's, and what I mean by that is the typical voucher receiving school is not actually this elite academy like you see in the movies or in kind of maybe the news sometimes. About every state's got a handful of very, very good elite private schools. Often they cost $40,000 a year to get into or something, but they exist. But that's not the typical school.
We're not sending our kids to Chilton from the Gilmore Girls.
Right. The voucher advocacy community sort of leverages that type of stereotype to say this is what you're getting. You know, and in fact, that's just not what happens. Most of these are subprime providers, often financially distressed. Often they close after opening some period of time. And the results show that. So whatever you can say, there's not a single thing that you can criticize public schools for that isn't doubly true about voucher schools and the private sector and voucher schools, except the idea that if your priority isn't academics, isn't exceptional learning, isn't reading and literacy and math and STEM learning, but is religious education, that is the one area that vouchers separate from public schools and avoid the so-called problem. So if that's your theory or diagnosis of what's wrong with public schools, is that they don't have religion in them, then you probably find vouchers fairly attractive. But even then, the schools are going to be doing the choosing, not you personally. So there's a really big myth. And I call it these voucher schemes, the education equivalent of predatory lending, for this reason, is that a lot of it is sort of plays on parents' desire to fix a problem or to get some help with something. And they're told that they can, that this is a solution to those problems, and those problems may be very real. And then they find once they're on their own with the dollars in hand, that there's no room for them at the end, and no school will take their kid. Or if they take their kid, they'll kick them out. And that's what happens too often, unfortunately.
Yeah. Our state superintendent likes to talk a lot about the need for schools to get back to basics. This is often in the context of accusing schools of spending too much time on, quote unquote, woke indoctrination or something. But, you know, the idea is that schools should do a better job teaching kids to read and do math and code and all that. There's an interesting counterexample you bring up in the book about the federally funded voucher program that existed for years in Washington, D.C., where over the years, studies found that voucher recipient religious schools produced worsening results. The kids did worse when they got there, in part because students received less instruction in reading and math, right? And I don't know. That one really stood out to me, in that it goes directly against a lot of the talking points about private schools.
100%. And those talking points were developed 30 years ago as part of litigation strategy, mostly. I mean, again, it was the entire basis of the early cases and vouchers were not religiously affiliated at the time, which is more closely related to what they're dealing with today, but based on this idea that public schools, in some cases correctly, that public schools were failing academically in some of these big urban areas like Cleveland, and this idea that parents should get an opt-out to solve that crisis on their own. The problem is that the solution's worse than the problem in these cases. And in specifically, it preys on this idea that there's room for everyone at these private schools, that all these private schools are elite and are going to do better than the typical public school. It's just simply not true. But what brought me into this debate as a researcher, or my bread and butter, was the specific claim that private schools were using vouchers were outperforming public schools. It's just simply not true. In fact, we've seen worse results for voucher schools than we've seen on almost any research question in the history of education. And so, you know, that was the thing. It's like, wait a minute, you know, claims like your superintendent running around saying we need to get back to the basics. Like, okay, I think a lot of folks are going to agree with that. But again, for the thousandth time, vouchers make things worse. No one's disputing that there was a learning loss associated with COVID-19 as an example. Vouchers, in some cases, have been even worse than the pandemic drop, specifically because the schools taking these children are not particularly interested or good at academic learning. They are much more focused on things ranging from everything from creationism instead of STEM learning to just simply not dealing with math and science in particular. Reading, you see less of a decline for kids who use vouchers, but math and science in particular, those basics have been absolutely dreadful when it comes to voucher schools.
Yeah, not to put too fine a point on it, but you're saying that there are cases where the effect of vouchers was worse than the effect of COVID on learning loss?
At least in two states, the Louisiana and Ohio, the effect of, if we're talking about who used a voucher to leave a public school and go to a private school, on average in Louisiana and in Ohio, where the question's been asked, it was twice what COVID-19 did to kids a few years later.
Oh. Well, one last thing. We're recording now, beginning of January. We're about to have a new presidential administration. And in your book, you talk about the first Trump administration and, you know, the tenure of Betsy DeVos as head of the U.S. Department of Education. And you summarize it this way. You said, what Trump did was put the politics of exclusion and resentment back into the voucher movement.
Yeah.
Looking ahead, with Trump back in office, with his next head of the education department, Linda McMahon, what do you anticipate for the next 4 years on the voucher front?
Well, you're going to see a push at the federal level to get a federal voucher bill, which is structured as a tax credit. It's essentially a tax shelter for wealthy people combined with a voucher bill coming out of the Fed. So we'll see how much success or failure they have getting that thing through. They haven't been able to yet. States like yours, like in Texas, like in Tennessee, some other states are going to try to keep ramming these things through. So I don't want to minimize that because that's going to happen and they're going to keep trying. And in some states, there's going to be success they're going to have in getting those things through to the detriment of learning for kids across each state. But I'm a little heartened actually by, despite obviously didn't support Trump in the election, but on election day, we also learned something else, which is, you know, going into the election day, voters had never, ever, ever before supported a voucher scheme when put to statewide vote. Never, ever. And that record was extended on election day. Three states where vouchers were directly on the ballot, not in gerrymandered legislative districts, not in courts, not at governors running on a whole bunch of things, not Trump himself. Let's talk about Kentucky, for example. 65% of voters in Kentucky voted for Donald Trump on election day, and 65% of voters in the same state rejected vouchers. 58% of voters in Nebraska rejected vouchers. A similar number supported Trump that day. What's really going on here is that in general, it's rural voters who can't stand these voucher schemes and have kept these things out of becoming law, whether in direct ballot or in some legislative cases. Often, I don't know the ins and outs of the whip counts in your state right now, but usually it's Republican opposition. It's Republican opposition by members who represent rural communities for the simple fact that there's no rural private schools, or there are very, very few. So these things are, about cash transfers to existing private school students. So, you know, what that tells me, you know, Kentucky, all 120 counties voted against vouchers, 119 of those by double digits. These are conservatives. These are people who voted for Donald Trump because they didn't see how vouchers are going to help them. They didn't see how Betsy DeVos or Milton Friedman or Charles Koch are going to help their family at that time. So I'm a little heartened by that. I don't want to diminish the fact that, you know, these legislators, these billions of dollars by a lot of legislators and a lot of legislative activity. They're going to keep trying to do it. But voters hate this stuff. We see this time and again. We saw it as recently as Election Day 24. And I do think in general, folks are going to understand when they're being lied to. And if it's not this year, it'll be in the future. They'll understand these things are deadly academically.
Well, again, thank you so much for taking the time. Thank you for this book. Again, for our listeners, we have with us Professor Josh Cowan. His book is The Privateers, How Billionaires Created a Culture War and Sold School Vouchers. If you really want to learn the ins and outs of this sort of push in our legislature, where it comes from and where it leads, I think this is essential reading.
I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to another episode of While I Breathe, the official podcast of the ACLU of South Carolina. If you're interested in learning more about the pitfalls of school vouchers, especially in South Carolina, or you just want a link to share with your friends laying out some of the arguments in this episode, check out our blog at aclusc.org. We have a new post out this week, The Ugly Truth About School Vouchers. It lays out six of the biggest problems with vouchers, and it's a hot topic, a timely topic, because our state legislators are already forcing through their latest version of this bad idea.
If you're interested in going deep on the topic of school vouchers, again, I highly recommend checking out Josh's book. It's called The Privateers, How Billionaires Created a Culture War and Sold School Vouchers, out in 2024 from Harvard Education Press. Another book that was really indispensable for me for understanding not just voucher lobbying, but the broader ecosystem of right-wing dark money is Jane Mayer's book, Dark Money: The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right. I read it while I was a reporter, and it really made me think differently about the whole ecosystem of studies and think tanks and the things that were being used to inform public policy. It was an eye-opener for me, certainly. Once again, thank you so much for listening. Tell your friends, leave a nice review if you think of it. Music on today's episode is by Daft Hartley.
And until next time, while I breathe, I hope.
An overtly faith-based. An overtly faith.
An overtly faith-based education